The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The VIX plunges, oil rallies, and inflation subsides. And our guest today, PJ Gorinsky, from Bespoke Market Intelligence. All this and much more on episode number 560 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and you are listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It is right now episode 560, and that coordinates to the second week of May 2018. And again, thanks for joining me. We have a good amount of things to talk about today. Markets were rather cooperative last week in the face of some things that maybe look like they were troubling. We had that Iran deal that we pulled out of, and there was some concern that, wow, wait a minute. Ooh, this is going to throw the world into a tizzy. But no, we continued on from where we saw the end of last week, where we saw a significant change in sentiment after the announcement from Apple. A few other companies provided their earnings. And then, of course, the Berkshire Hathaway information that they were buying an incredible amount of shares of Apple and stood behind the company, the world's largest company, they were continuing to buy into. And that actually created a significant amount of sentiment change for markets, where we saw that the VIX dropped down. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 570 points for the week, up about 2.5%. The S&P 500 up also 2.4%. The NASDAQ climbed 2.7%. And the small caps continued to rally pretty significantly. And this whole thing, the news on the U.S. pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, the bad deal, and President Trump saying, hey, you know what? I'm keeping to my promise that I said back during the campaign and throughout when I was elected. This is the worst deal ever, and they're not showing signs of helping out or slowing down. They, in fact, may even be creating and making and manufacturing nuclear weapons. And you know what? We're not doing this anymore. And on that announcement, ahead of the announcement, and then on the announcement itself and throughout the week, we saw that oil rallied. And one of the big things that happened with oil was, if you remember, as oil was coming down and prices came down significantly, the entire oil sector got beat up pretty good. We saw that earnings slipped into the negative territory. We saw that many wells were being capped. We saw that companies were going out looking for debt. We saw that their bonds and their pricing of their bonds really sunk down through the junk level. Some companies went out of business. I mean, there was a lot of carnage in the oil sector. There was a lot of problems there. And then as we are seeing that companies, and this happens more often than not, they really start to buckle down. They cut expenses, they fire people, they streamline the operation in order to make sure that the company stays afloat as best as possible, as long as possible, until something changes. If it doesn't, and if they can't last, well, they're going to have to go bankrupt and close up shop. But the companies that actually were able to provide for this kind of rainy day, or even more than a rainy day, it was a significant maelstrom, were able to weather the storm here. And when oil started to come back, rallying over 50, over 60, now into the 70 range, you're seeing that many companies are doing much better, and they're able to, in fact, look to provide profitability. Oil companies have done really well of late. The oil sector in general has done really well. And that then translates into a portion of the earnings for the S&P 500 that will be positive probably looking back, especially because there are very, let's say, weak comps. You know, the ability to beat the comps from a year ago or 2 years ago and show growth now that oil is in the $70 range, pretty easy. One of the things that we knew from the S&P earnings in total for a long time was that the negative impact of the oil sector and anything related to the oil sector was very significant. And we really need to put that into a kind of a side pocket. Put it over to the side for a minute. because we need to look at the rest of the earnings and see how that was going. And time again, it was doing better. Now that you add in the fact that many of these companies that were showing negative earnings growth and revenues that were slowing considerably will have the opportunity to do a lot better and show that the margins are expanding and the ability to really post some decent numbers here as oil prices move higher, well, that's a good thing. Now, CPI came in a little bit softer than expected, just ever so slightly. And actually, the market saw that as good news. Remember something, that inflation, while it looks to be that there is inflation and inflation is on the rise, we don't have to see a continual absolute rise each and every single month to a point that it gets out of control. Of course, that's possible. A lot of people are speculating that, yep, we are seeing a time where we're going to see superinflation, just hyperinflation take over and, oh my gosh, let's kind of run for cover and all that. But in fact, when you think about it for a moment, it doesn't actually have to be a straight line. It could be, you know, up a little bit, down a little bit, up a little bit. But the long-term nature of what's happening right now with inflation is clearly that it's moving higher. But markets saw this as a good thing, because if you think about what's going on with regard to all of the conversations that you've seen out of the Fed recently, whereas the Fed has been commenting about inflation more often than they have been in some time, they're putting a little bit of a concern in the minds of investors, thinking that they're going to be on a rate hiking mission for some time, and it's starting to get ingrained and people are worried about this. That's why we see that the yield curve has been flattening a bit. The 10-year is about 3%. But just realize something, that while it is in fact a really important item to be looked at, no question about that, and a rising interest rate environment overall is actually negative in the long haul for stocks, at the same time, it doesn't necessarily have to be every single month, month in and month out. Maybe the recent rise of the dollar benefited the current inflation number. Maybe, you know, we're just seeing some stabilization at this point for a little while, and hopefully we won't see runaway inflation. We don't want that, obviously. But markets did see this as a good number, because really they looked at it simply as, well, it looks obvious that while we're seeing an uptick in inflation, we're not at an overheating scenario just yet. Now let's take a quick turn over to the VIX, because clearly what we've seen was a very slow, deliberate, but slow and sure continuation of the VIX on the way down. It closed in at $12.65, sub 13 on Friday. Remember, just a couple of months ago, this was back over 50. A lot of people had bet that it was going to be falling down significantly. Unfortunately, they had the right bet, the wrong instrument, when they used that VIX short ETF, which got hammered due to that very bizarre, you know, 50% move or 100% move on the day up to about 50. But there's a change since then, slowly but surely, of market psychology. Remember, recently we had Dr. Daniel Crosby on, and he studies behavioral finance. Because what we know is that investors fuel the market. They fuel it through their thoughts and their emotions, their mental moves, mental moods. It all matters. It all comes into play, because you can have it's like anything else in life, right? You can have a great day, but somebody's honoring it for some reason and just kind of screws everything all up. The same thing with the markets. Fear and greed clearly are some of the biggest components that we deal with on a daily and weekly and monthly and yearly basis, because things swing. There's groupthink that goes on, of course. And what happens is sometimes it infects the mood of investors one way or another. That could be positive or negative. It could cause investors to really get upset and start to sell off stocks for the wrong reasons, possibly, or for the right reasons. Or it can lead people to buy things for the wrong reasons or right reasons. I mean, how many times do you see just a great stock tip on TV? You get all jazzed up and run up about it, and you're like, oh, I got to get that stock. Look at that presentation that was made on TV. And what do? Go out and buy it, and it was all based on emotion, not really research or any kind of other work that was done to look at maybe the technicals. You know, just you did it because of an emotional, I got to have that. You know, the greed in us got to us, and we're going to buy that stock because it looks so good. And doesn't work out. Or you hold on to a stock because you believe, man, this is a good company. GE, great example. Yeah, it's a great company, man. What could go wrong here? Keeps on going down and down and down because, we wanted it to believe. Or on the other hand, how about where there's a bad news item that comes out and maybe something on an individual name that comes up and there's a big sell-off and you say, oh, man, I'm not going to hold on to this. I'm really worried. I'm fearing what's going on and I'm going to get out of this stock right now. And you have to look at that, you know, and you just look back to the latest presidential election that we know that there was a great, you know, a tremendous amount of fear that maybe if President Trump got elected and all these things that he was talking about came to fruition, oh my God, this is going to be terrible for the world and all this is going to be awful. But that changed in a jiffy, didn't it? When the realization came out that the first order of business was going to be this massive stimulus plan through tax cuts. Markets rallied for months. And why? Because there was the prospect of better earnings for companies and more money for individuals. And there was going to be this really great opportunity. And we all believe that once it got done, that this is really going to be great. And it is. I mean, earnings are a lot better for companies. And we're seeing that paychecks for individuals are better. Unemployment rate is 3.9%. So far, so good. But realize that sometimes the collective minds of investors will also react much differently than expected. And that's kind of what's been going on to a degree recently with some earnings. I want you to think about this for a second, where the times that you've seen where companies have actually reported good numbers, everything looks good, their outlook looked good, somehow this stock just got obliterated, falls hard on the numbers. You're like, what's going on? Well, there's a collective mindset, a kind of a hive mentality, a herding mentality that comes with stocks sometimes and comes with information that is really not actually seen on the surface. What we can say sometimes is that when it comes to markets, comes to stocks, when it comes to investing, the trend followers or the chart analysts, the technical analysts, are the ones that really have the benefit of understanding what's going on because they don't really look at anything more than price action. And price action dictates what's going on from the masses. If, in fact, you looked at recently the Apple situation, you saw there was a so-so quarter that happened and you're like, maybe it's time to get out of Apple. And we're seeing that there is all these analysts that are dropping their estimates and iPhone production numbers and all this. And there's really not a lot of new technology they're coming out with and on and on and on and on. But meanwhile, the stock hits a new high recently. Now, if you stuck to the fundamentals, what would have happened? What would have happened is that you would have been brought into the idea that, well, on these few data points here, I'm out. Now, if you combine the fundamentals and the technicals, you'd be a little bit better off because you would have said, maybe, okay, you know what? I see all this information, but the stock is still holding up here. Maybe I'll wait for a break of this level and then do something versus just relying on one or the other. And again, you know me. I like to look at both. As a matter of fact, for our managed growth strategy, we look at both. We look at the fundamentals and the technicals. We do a quantitative-based research on finding the names, and then we look at both fundamentals to find out where we want to be. We look at volume numbers. We look at price numbers. We look at ratios. We look at a lot of different things that go into it from both a technical and a fundamental standpoint because I think it's important to do so. I think it's really important to do so. If you find yourself getting banged around a little bit because you're on one side versus the other, think about combining both sets of analysis-based research and really look at that as the tools that you can use to give you a better judgment. You look at last week when CPI came out, we talked about it a second ago. Well, you may have thought it was kind of a negative issue, but markets liked it. Now, one way to get better insights, as we've mentioned, is to know what the masses are doing. And there's a lot of ways to do that. Again, we can look at a chart and understand how the price action of a stock is doing. We can do things like our next guest does, and that does looks at trends and gains kind of a better understanding of what others are seeing to take a look at what's happening. And he does it through a variety of surveys and gaining and gathering market intelligence. We're going to get to that in one second. I just want to mention before we do so, next week's guest, Keith McCullough from HedgeEye, will be our guest. Do not miss that episode. It's going to be kind of cool, I'm sure. Lot to talk about with him. He's pretty negative on the markets right now, so we'll find out what's going on there. But right now, it's time. Let's get to the discussion with our guest of the week. And our guest today is PJ Gorinsky. He's the co-founder of Bespoke Market Intelligence. You probably heard about them. They're, you know, with some great reports, get a lot of press on CNBC and a variety of other areas. And PJ handles the day-to-day operations of the company and does the survey programming, which we're going to talk about, product design, research and analytics, sales, audience procurement, all this good stuff. So we're going to talk about a variety of things because they had some really interesting stuff. But I want to get it from you. PJ, tell me and tell my listeners kind of, you know, about what your company does.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, thanks for having me. I appreciate getting to talk to you a little bit here today. So I'll give you the real quick background on us is we are a primary research firm, and we primarily use surveys to collect our data. So the quick background is I was working at Glenview Capital, which is now upwards of $10 billion under management, long short equity fund in New York. And at Glenview, they had a very heavy focus on using primary source data to confirm or refute investment assumptions, to help generate ideas, to help defensively monitor positions. And I worked on a team there that was exclusively dedicated to doing that. I really enjoyed the research, and I thought that I could build a platform using surveys as a tool for collecting that data, and then just work with a lot of hedge funds to basically be like their team down the hall, so to speak, that's doing it for them. Mm-hmm. So I started it 6 years ago. I went to the guys at Bespoke Investment Group, Justin and Paul, and partnered with them on it and launched the business 6 years ago now in Harrison, New York. And we do work for hedge funds, for private equity firms, for corporations. And the really cool thing for me is I get to track interesting trends that are going on with names that a lot of people care about. So I'll get to study names like Facebook and Netflix and Apple and Chipotle and things that you kind of see in everyday life. And you get to work with some really smart people who have some really smart theories and narratives that they're testing on these names, kind of getting back to the deep fundamental research of tracking trends over time and figuring out dislocations in market sentiment reality to help them in their process and just be one part of what they do. So we use surveys to collect the data. We work with market research panels, and we go to them and basically say, we designed a survey. We did it in our software. We're going to give you a link to the survey, and it's done all electronically. They send it out to, you know, if we get 1,000 or 2,000 consumer survey responses from them, they send it out to their panelists. Their panelists take the surveys. We see the results come in. And then what's really important for us is we keep things really consistent, and we track the changes in the data over time, and we add new things to the surveys, you know, when they pop up. So an example of that is we track all things related to Facebook, and then Facebook comes out and says that they're going to get into online dating, and we add some questions on online dating to get some quick feedback from them.
Yeah, I want to go through that whole online dating thing because I think that's pretty fascinating. But I want to understand a little bit more about your surveys for a second here. So when you send out these surveys, are these the respondents or the people that are taking these surveys, are they paid? Is it unpaid? Is it how do you decide who gets the survey?
Yeah, absolutely. So they are compensated. There are market research panels. Usually the one that most people have heard of is SurveyMonkey Audience, but there are others like ResearchNow and SSI, and they have literally millions and millions of consumers in there that take surveys. And the way it kind of works is the respondent takes surveys regularly. They get reward points that build up over time. SurveyMonkey Audience will, the reward is having a small charitable contribution made to a charity that they choose from a list. And that's kind of the motivation for the people to take the surveys. And then we just pay the market research panel a per response price for getting those respondents. So they've got, and they usually recruit them through like large loyalty programs and social media and different avenues where they, you know, attract them to their panel and then, you know, get them to take surveys on a regular basis to be part of that program. And then we tap into that stream essentially.
And then you then of course take it and formulate it to provide the output, if you will, you know, it's kind of the results and to make it so it's coherent. And then from what I've heard, you then will put it in a usable fashion so that you can then test some of the thesis based on that with relation to, you know, stocks and stock trends, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we pull the data into, you know, Excel, and then we will track issues over time, and we have a whole system for getting it updated into our reports. And the key with us that I think is interesting is we do these surveys longitudinally. So over a long period of time, most hedge funds, when they have a thesis that they need to test, if, you know, Facebook was coming onto their radar at the end of last year, they would just run a survey at that time and say, let's find out what consumers think about Facebook and what they're doing. For us, what makes us interesting is we're running these surveys for 6 years now on Facebook. So when you ask consumers how often they're visiting Facebook, what percentage of them have an account, how they feel about privacy, how they feel about newsfeed, we've got data going back 6 years on that and going back 6 years on iPhone launches and how excited consumers were at each launch. So that makes it even more interesting to be able to see the historical tail behind every data point, and it makes the analysis all the more interesting.
Right, because the trends of the consumer. Now, is there a correlation, have you found, between the consumer trends and really what happens? Is there a very tight correlation there, or is it kind of something that you need to really just use as a secondary source of information?
So we have some clients that take the data and plug them directly into models. We always... I think one thing that's really important with alternative data sources is knowing what your data is really good for and knowing what it's not good for. We typically don't like to use our data to try to quote unquote call quarters. So a lot of funds will use credit card data and they'll have direct, really tight correlations to performance for a particular stock. And they'll know based on that data what's going to basically go on as the quarter progresses. For us, we know that so consumers are inherently flawed in that they're not terribly great at remembering everything that they did a couple months ago, let alone a month ago.
Right.
So we know what we can ask them that would add value. And to say to clients, you know, if you see maybe like a 3-4% wiggle in this metric quarter over quarter, it's not necessarily forecasting that, you know, they're going to make or miss DAUs or MAUs. But we could give you some really interesting perspective on what percentage of online dating users plan to use Facebook and how Facebook users feel about privacy compared to Snapchat users and Instagram users and Twitter users. So that's kind of the home for our stuff, is more longer term thesis assumptions and less, you know, we're heading into the quarter, here's a direct correlation that's going to tell you whether, you know, Facebook is going to make or miss their DAU number, or Netflix is going to make or miss their net ads number.
So let's talk a little bit about this whole new Facebook online dating discussion that was announced, I guess, about a week ago or so. And, you know, obviously Facebook has tried other, you know, a lot of these companies, they find out what's working at other places and they just say, well, we got the user base. What the hell? We'll just restructure. We'll rebrand something. We'll change a few things. And Facebook really has to, for a lot of these, like when they went into the business, remember they were going into competition with LinkedIn?
Right.
I don't know what ever happened to that, but okay, maybe that's doing something. And they were going to do jobs. I think there was some discussion about them doing jobs. Now they're getting into the area of dating. So you did a survey on that. What were you looking for? What did you find out?
Sure. So firstly, just because I think it's interesting now that you brought it up with going against LinkedIn, Facebook had come up with their Facebook for Work and Facebook Marketplace at around the same time. One of them was kind of targeted at, let's be like eBay and Etsy and have users sell to other users. And the other was, let's be a little bit more like LinkedIn. In our surveys, the Facebook for Work has not caught on very much at all, but the Facebook Marketplace stuff actually has gained a lot of traction with consumers, with users of Facebook. So I just figured share that anecdote quickly.
Okay.
In terms of the online dating stuff, what we found at least was that, you know, over 70% of Facebook users who are online dating users already are likely to try out Facebook's new dating platform. So there are a bunch of implications for that. Firstly, you would think for the online dating companies that can't necessarily be a good thing if their users are highly likely to try Facebook out for online dating. I think to kind of give a counterpoint to that, when we ask all consumers, regardless of whether they're an online dating user, a fairly high percentage of them say that they're going to try it out. I think it's around 23 or 24% of Facebook users said that they would try it out. Our incidence rate on the percentage of all consumers who are online dating users is around 12 or 13%. So whilst most people will focus right away on, is this really bad for Match and for Tinder that Facebook's getting into this and all their users are going to start trying Facebook, it's important to also note that you may see some new users come into the space in general, and then maybe they try Facebook and then also, you know, give Match and Tinder a shot. So,
you know, but let me just back up for a second. Let me back you up for a second here. So it would seem to me the people that are in the market for dating, there is a terminal number of people that are single at any given time well, let's just say the US for a second here, or in your area. I don't know, you know, let's just say your region, your area. And for those people that are inclined to be involved with an online dating service of any type, I don't care what that is, but something, whether you're swiping or you're maybe doing some kind of a more sophisticated survey type of thing, right? Depending on, I guess, what you're looking for and your time frame of what you're looking for, you know, how much. But it would seem to me that it would be a no-brainer that someone who's in the market that is looking to date, that either wants to do it for just meeting people or is doing it for the benefit of getting married long-term and kind of that whole thing, it would seem to me that they would try every possible outlet available. Am I wrong? And why? And in other words, why not use Facebook if they're coming out with it? Who cares? I'll try it.
Yeah. I mean, especially if all the services, if there are free levels of all the services, why wouldn't you try to get on as many of them as possible?
Exactly.
So I think that's the other thing too, is it's not a zero sum game with online dating. And in general, you know, the buy side at least likes the online dating space as an avenue to invest in. We've been seeing that online dating users in general become increasingly likely to be willing to pay for premium services. And you're seeing more and more people over time get into using online dating as the younger respondents who grew up with it get older, and then the new younger respondents come in and start to use online dating. So I think you're definitely right that, like, why not try Facebook and why not try the others?
Yeah.
So it's not a zero sum game.
And they're all different, because my understanding is that Facebook is not going to be geared like a swipe left and right, you know, which is looking for those are used for a more casual encounter.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the interesting thing that we saw in some of the survey responses is we asked people who said, yes, I would try Facebook, and no, I wouldn't, to fill in why they would and why they wouldn't. And when people said, were giving us reasons for why they would try it, some of them were even saying, look, like, we already use this for meeting people anyway. So, like, to an extent, it's already kind of a social, we're meeting people type of service. So I don't think it's too much of a stretch for them to get into a different type of, like, a more formalized online dating platform.
Right.
But I think that the use case is definitely there for it. And the main reason why people who say they don't want to use it don't say they're not going to use it is privacy issues, which I'm sure is because a lot of consumers are exposed to those news pieces coming out about Facebook and privacy and Cambridge Analytica and the like.
The former Cambridge company called Cambridge Analytica.
Right. Absolutely.
Now out of business and defunct. But I have a question about Facebook. Something's in Twitter, for that matter. You know about these pretty significantly, I know. So I'm pretty active on, for example, Twitter, the mobile app.
Right.
Very rarely do I, every once in a while, I use the web-based app. Every once in a while, and historically, I've been on Facebook. And, you know, you hear about all these great, you know, the advertising that goes on all that. I don't, unless I am totally stupid, very rarely do I see any advertisement in my Twitter stream, in my Twitter feed. Every once in a while you see something sponsored here or there or something like that. Is it just me?
No, I mean, people definitely do notice, at least when we ask them if they notice the advertising in their newsfeed. And they definitely see it pop up. One of the things that I think has been really interesting to track, and it kind of played out with Facebook in the beginning of this year when Zuckerberg came out and announced that they had to kind of do an overhaul of newsfeed, is we've been asking for clients for a long time now. We pose to Facebook users, do you feel that the ads that are showing up in your newsfeed are getting more relevant, are getting higher quality and more specific to you? For a really long time, that metric was going up, and it seemed like Facebook was really knocking it out of the park with how they were managing newsfeed. Unsurprisingly, at the same time, annoyance with ads was going down. So they were really doing a good job and a nice job with their users. Then toward the end of, I think it was 2016, that trend started to reverse, and it accelerated throughout 2017, where annoyance with ads was going up and their sentiment that the ads were getting more relevant to them was starting to go down. So we were able to see in advance. So I guess to suffice to say, we were not surprised when Zuckerberg came out and said that there was a potential issue with newsfeed and that users were getting upset about it, because they were telling us that they were starting to get upset about it and that the ads were probably too crowded and starting to get less relevant again. So I think that there is an element with all these social media sites of having to manage ad load. And for them, they collect all this information and data on us so that they could put more relevant ads in front of us. And if all these issues around privacy are starting to come up and that leads to people opting out of that stuff or them having to throttle back how much they collect on you, now the ads will start to get less relevant and people will start to get more upset about it and maybe disengage a little bit. And then maybe you actually see some different behavior from advertisers, you know, at the end of that chain, whether it's that they advertise less or they pull back spend or they are not willing to spend as much per unit.
It seems to me from this whole privacy issue and combining what you mentioned about the ads and, of course, a changing environment. Listen, just it wasn't too many years ago that MySpace was hot and then it wasn't. I'm not suggesting that Facebook is that kind of situation, but I don't know about you. I use Facebook much less, not only because of this privacy thing, but I use Facebook only every once in a while to see what a couple of people are doing here or there. Most of this stuff doesn't interest me. I don't see ads. I don't see them. I don't know. Unless they're totally disguised somehow, I wouldn't even know what to look at. Every once in a while, something sponsored here or there, but I just don't see them. I mean, I see maybe one ad every couple of days, maybe on Twitter. On Facebook, I hardly see them also, but that's me. I don't know. Again, maybe there's totally. And if they are hiding them so well, congratulations. You know, I mean, that's really a good job. I mean, that's impressive. It is, because I wouldn't even know it's an ad. Is it somebody showing me their dog licking an ice cream cone in an ad? I guess. I don't know. But, you know, it's kind of crazy. So it would seem to me, though, that with this privacy concern, with turning on some of these issues, people backing away, the knowledge that and maybe people don't care. What does the survey say for survey says? What does the survey say for people's concern over privacy? Do you have that information?
Yeah, we've been getting some really interesting stuff on that. So what I would say is, so our stuff started picking up on engagement slides, especially from millennials with Facebook a while ago. So we kind of knew that the younger populations were starting to move away from Facebook or at least not visiting as frequently or spending as much time there. When we've asked all these follow-up questions about Facebook and privacy and other concerns, what concerns us is that the feedback from Facebook users is a lot worse than the feedback about similar questions for Snapchat and Instagram and Twitter. So Facebook users are the most likely by far to tell us that they're actively trying to cut back on their Facebook usage. We kind of liken it to how you would have asked questions years ago about people trying to quit smoking. There's a very different way of phrasing it, whether they're trying to quit or actually have quit. So if you ask what percentage of Facebook people have or former Facebook users have actually quit, you'll get a much lower percentage than people who are saying, I'm trying to cut back. And that should be a really interesting leading indicator proxy type metric for figuring out where engagement is shifting on these platforms. So I think that the concerning thing for Facebook is that their users, A, they are upset with privacy. They're more upset about privacy than users of other platforms. Their users think that their data is more at risk on Facebook than users of other platforms. And there are also a lot of other concerns that people haven't really been talking as much about lately. So when we ask consumers if they have fears about whether Facebook is good for their personal health or their mental health, their concerns about that are much greater than concerns of users on other platforms. And we've seen some former Facebook executives kind of roll out of Facebook and talk about, you know, how that's a concern for them, that it's not a great force for the world or that it could cause, you know, people to get addiction to it or to get kind of a reliance on seeing likes and whatever, you know, chemical brain activity happens when you see likes on your photos or on messaging and that people see their friends doing things and it makes them depressed. There's definitely an element of that in the surveys. Like when we look at 18 to 24 year olds who don't use Facebook and ask them why, it's the only platform with the only age cohort to get the word it's depressing or causes me to be depressed out of all the platforms.
Yeah, because it's all about FOMO. I mean, some of the other ones are just easy. I mean, first of all, who's going to be upset about me sending them a picture of my face with a dog licking, you know, a dog face on Snapchat to somebody? There's no FOMO. Right, there's no FOMO about that, right? Or changing my voice and making my face look, it's funny, send it to a few people, whatever. It's when we get into this whole, oh, I want that. And I don't think I can ever have that. And the truth of the matter is, so much of that isn't really what's happening anyway. I'm not saying it's green screened, but it's the
people are putting their best parts of their life up on Facebook. Right.
So I started my kids convinced me to start an Instagram account recently. I really don't. I mean, I get it. I don't want to sound like an old fogey. That's not the point. I didn't get it for why do you have Facebook? Why do you have Twitter? Twitter's great, by the way. Twitter is my for business. You know what I'm talking about here. It's the best way to curate data. It's just you can get the news. Basically, you have like an RSS feed of your news and your information. Some of it is stupid. You have to get rid of it. Some people just repeat themselves constantly and you have to get rid of that. Right. But aside from that, there's a really good, easy way to have a nice conversation, find out what people are saying. I usually just listen and read what the main person is saying. I don't go down deep into the comments because it gets kind of crazy sometimes. And Instagram, I'm like, okay, it's all about a picture. And I'm thinking, oh, and my son says, oh, look at these. I'm like, oh, it's all these pictures of girls at the beach. And this, I'm like, why are they taking pictures of themselves all day long? I don't, and it's very nice, but I'm like, I don't get it. So they convinced me to do a food. I always take food pictures. Always, always. I have years and years of my iPhone is stacked. I take more food pictures than I do my family pictures, right? They're like, oh, let me see your family. I'm like, well, here it is. Here's my son, creme brulee. And here's, you know, it's crazy. Here's my daughter, T-bone steak. So I started, I started this thing and I get it. You know, it's kind of interesting where, okay, people are interested in something that you're interested in. They want to see the pictures and all. But again, I'm like, to what end is this? Facebook, though, the problem is the political, the negative, the look at what they're doing and the comments about it. And, you know, even my wife's like, oh, I got to get these pictures up on Facebook. I'm like, why? Why do you have to tell people where you are all the time? And I could see how people could be getting, it could be getting kind of a little cooked on the whole thing. So that's what you're telling me what's happening though, right?
Yeah. So you're starting to just see some fatigue from consumers, I guess is the way that I would describe it. I don't think that we're going to see just a massive exodus from Facebook and it's going to fall off the face of the earth. And we always caveat our comments on Facebook on the consumer front by saying Instagram is owned by Facebook and it is doing insanely well in our surveys, probably the best out of any platform that we track. It's gaining so much popularity and it's doing really well with advertisers too. So we used to run advertiser surveys in 2016. We refreshed one recently. Instagram's growth there has been remarkable. And you know, all these concerns that we're talking about with Facebook, advertisers right now are still, they're not letting up yet and they're not lagging yet. Maybe if this is why we're so, you know, excited to continue tracking this stuff going forward, because maybe if you see consumer fatigue worsen and people start using it less and less, that the advertisers would follow. But right now they're still saying that they're spending more year over year and quarter over quarter. They're still saying that they would pay more per ad unit. They're still saying that Facebook is really important to their business.
Meanwhile, you got companies like Procter & Gamble pulling their entire targeted campaigning process, saying it's not working.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that's, I think that it's going to be really important to continue running these to see if that grows, if there are more people that kind of follow suit and start doing that as well.
Yeah. I mean, because Instagram right now, you know, there's a whole pocket of advertising that goes on with Instagram that has nothing to do and never will have anything to do with Facebook. So you have all these people that are doing travel, food, / you know, pick your poison, whatever, spot, whatever it is, right? Interest, you know, an interest, you know, feeds of interest, if you will. And they're actually getting paid directly. Right. From the restaurant or from, you know, maybe the hotel. Travel and Leisure is a big one because there's obviously a lot of picture potential there. But they're getting paid directly from them. And that's something that goes outside the realm of Instagram / Facebook payments. So it'd have to be, you know, somebody like on a Snap. I mean, Snap is, in my opinion, Snap always is going to have a hard time getting income because, you know, for me, I just send stuff directly to whoever I'm sending it to. I'm not reading. Am I going to read the Snap story, daily story from ExxonMobil? Not happening.
Right.
You know, just not happening. So, but anyway, so we'll see what happens. I think it's going to be very fascinating because there is, as we have seen, a drop off of younger users and obviously moving into more of, you know, the Snap and the Instagram and all that. What about Netflix? Let's talk about this because Netflix, you know, what they did was pretty fascinating. They obviously took over the whole area of downloadable / streaming. you know, television. And then when that kind of, you know, they did brilliant, right? So they were in the, you send me a DVD. You could sign up to 5 per month, the 3 outstanding, whatever it was, send it back and forth. They did that to a great degree. Then they said, you know what? That's going away. Let's do streaming. Then when streaming is like, okay, well, what are we going to do now? And they came up with original content. And a lot of their original content is obviously very good. Now, other companies are coming up with original content, so we're not sure what the next generation of Netflix is going to be, but obviously because they have a very sticky platform, anybody that you ask, and you could probably tell me better from your surveys, it's like, if you survey how much you're paying for your Netflix, like, I'm not sure. You know, I think it's $14. I don't know. I just kind of, it just automatically pays. Would you stop paying for Netflix? No, it's so cheap. It's really relatively inexpensive. I don't really care. I got a couple of people in my family. Is there the potential for a change? Are they going to be introducing advertising on their platform, and how will people deal with that? Is cord cutting definitely helping that? I mean, tell me a little bit about the kind of whole Netflix story.
Yeah, so with Netflix, the thing that we constantly get amazed at is the pricing power that they have with consumers. So there is definitely cord cutting going on, and it has continued, and it does benefit Netflix. I think one of the things that's been an interesting trend is we've seen that basically anybody that gets a smart TV winds up with a Netflix subscription. So in our trackers, when you see, you know, TVs have not been really hot for a long time in terms of like a major refresh cycle, but over time, people, whenever they're getting these smart TVs, they are using Netflix on it. It's the primary way that they're consuming Netflix. So you see this pricing power, though, that is fascinating, where, you know, we ask consumers at what price they would cancel, and the average price, and this is like if Netflix keeps increasing pricing, is like $18 or $19 a month. And ask them before, you know, at all these different hypothetical price points, at what price point do you agree that Netflix is a great deal? And Netflix is still viewed as a great deal at higher price points than it is now. And I think the thing that was important is, our tracker from before the price increases to after Netflix increased their price increase, people just revised higher the price that they thought Netflix was a great deal at. So they have pricing power with their consumers. They're doing really well with their original content strategy. It's generating subscriptions for them. It's importantly making consumers way less likely to cancel their subscription and to stick with Netflix over time. You definitely see more increased competition in the space. More people are using Amazon Prime, people using Hulu. Disney is going to have an offering that people will use, obviously. But they're cheap enough that if people are cutting the cord and kind of going to a skinny bundle, Netflix is one of a bunch of services that you'll use. And I think in the pecking order, Netflix is viewed as being pretty important. And the one indicator that we always track with all these services, the biggest thing that causes people to cancel a service like that is, I don't use the service enough. And that's why there's not pricing, it's not selection, it's not any other specific thing. It's, I don't use the service enough. And then when we ask Netflix users how often they use the service, their engagement with the service is obscenely high. It's like, I forget the exact percentage. I think nearly 75, 80% say they watch something almost every day on Netflix. So that puts them at a pretty low risk to lose their subscribers because everybody's using it so often.
I have the $14.95. I think it's 14. Again, I'm not exactly sure, actually. I think it's $14.95. I have the 4K package, and I got, I think, 5 family members or something like that, right? So whether I use it or not is not the issue. It's if I turned it off, my kids would absolutely come and just, you know, somehow rally me to, Dad, no, it's, you know, you put it for us.
Right. I need this.
I need it to survive. I need it to live. I can't live without it, but my kids use it all the time. They watch stuff over and over and over again. And obviously, they haven't seen all the movies that I've seen because I'm a lot older. Right. So I've seen all the old ones. They get to see them now, but, they're really loving the whole Netflix thing. I watch it. I find some cool stuff on it, but I'm not enamored with it. It's good. It's very good, but they need it. But then again, I pay $300 a month for my cable, my home cable, which is, you know, they're like, what's wrong with you? I'm like, I don't know. I can't talk about, you know, I'm trying to give it up, right? Like you talked about cigarettes. I'm trying to give up the cable. I can't, it's too easy to use. You get to record everything, you know, and see all the sports and stuff like that. The thought of reconfiguring a Roku box or a Sling is just a little bit too much for me. But, So we see this going on. Let's just get back for one second on, the idea of social media for a second, because I know you do a lot of work in that area. So, you know, Twitter's been coming up. The stock's been coming up like crazy. There was a lot of, you know, ideas that, they're going to start doing a little bit of this. They got the NFL. They got that. And they're going to cut some expenses because they were in the toilet for a long time, right? And Facebook was eating their lunch and all that. And I've always thought that Twitter was actually a better service. Forget about a company. Forget about a business. A better service. I always thought Snapchat was a piece of crap that there's no way they're going to make money. I love the service, by the way. Terrible company. Right. So is anyone making very big strides? I guess Instagram is the one, right?
Yeah, so Instagram is doing phenomenally well in the surveys and basically everything that we test. The thing that I think is really interesting about Twitter that people don't really think about it this way, but it's less social and it's more, you kind of alluded to this before, it's more news and it's almost become a utility for people at least people that use it. So when we ask people, like we've been testing for a long time, what do people use all the different services for? And Twitter is like overwhelmingly and by far for news. You get news faster and in a more concise fashion on Twitter than you do anywhere else. And I think that's something that's made its performance fairly consistent, is that they have a lot of users who it's a free service and they view it as their source to get news. So they don't, once they got kind of worked out a lot of their problems, they're not losing people because they see it as so important to get their news flow.
Right.
So I think that's what's made Twitter, and they are going into doing other initiatives with live events and things like that. Snapchat, I think one thing that's really interesting that we've been tracking for a long time is...
Please don't say the glasses. Don't say the glasses.
No, not the glasses.
Oh, thank goodness.
This is not going to be a positive Snapchat data point. So this is... We take Instagram users and we show tracked over like 45, 46 months, what percentage of them also have a Snapchat account and what percentage of daily Instagram users also visited Snapchat that day. And if you follow the tracker, there's a data point where it goes from growing to being totally flat. And that data point is literally the month that Instagram released Instagram stories.
Yep.
So I think that's had a material impact on Snapchat's growth into Instagram's user base, because you especially think about it, and we do so much work on understanding what convinces people to use social media platforms. And if a person that's in an older age cohort is looking to interact with their friends and they're already on there with Instagram and there are fewer of their friends on Snapchat, and now they could get substantially the same experience on Instagram that they got on Snapchat. Mm-hmm. What's the reason for them to try Snapchat? They could post a story. They could look at a story. They could send their friend a message. They could post photos. You know, I just don't see the reason. I don't think they see it either. What's the reason for them to try Snapchat if they get the same experience on Instagram now that Instagram has stories and they get more of their friends there because it's linked to Facebook, which is where a lot of their friends were to begin with?
Yeah, exactly. All right, PJ, speaking of which, how do people find you over on Twitter?
So we're at Bespoke Intel on Twitter.
Bespoke Intel. And we'll put all the information on how to get in touch with you and check out the market intelligence and all the things that you have to offer over on the show notes for episode number, 560 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. PJ, thanks for coming aboard. Appreciate all your great and really fascinating insights and surveys and all that. And we'll see you soon.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, thanks. Good stuff. No question about that. Very good conversation. And always learning something on the show. That's the whole point, right? The whole point is to bring on guests. And selfishly, I learn a lot. It's not just all about bringing somebody to introduce to the audience. Not at all. We're all learning. I get to speak to some great guests that I maybe wouldn't have the opportunity to speak to if we didn't do this podcast and this show and this whole format. It's really quite wonderful. I'll be in New York City with a jam-packed schedule, actually, doing some recordings for several upcoming shows. The speakers and keynotes and presenters at the Benzinga FinTech Award. That's going to be next week. I'm actually going to have a whole studio set up there and interviewing all sorts of people that are going to be really interesting. I am very excited about what we're going to be bringing to the show over the next several weeks with this. So stick around for that. It's going to be really cool. Do me a favor. Make sure to tell your friends, tweet this, retweet this, send it out, send it on Facebook, Instagram. I don't care. Send it out there about the Disciplined Investor Podcast. You know, I want to make sure that we reach as many people as possible on a regular basis to give them all the information, education, and insights about markets and investing that we can. Help out somebody. Give them the insight. Give them the benefit. Tell them about, hey, this guy Horowitz He's got some shows, some guests. It's really kind of cool. You got to listen to this podcast. You know, podcasts are really popular and people love it. So just make sure, send a couple of emails out for me, won't you? I'd really appreciate that. And by the way, speaking about checking something out, Envestology has a, we had a new facelift, kind of a new interface, about 95% of the way done, but yeah, it's available for you. If you go over to Envestology with an E, E-N-V-E-S-T-O-L-O-G-Y, Envestology, Envest, if you go there and click on the login or, you know, client login, and just go register if you haven't registered yet, but go check it out. What you'll find there is that you can, it's a free registration. You don't have to worry about anything. No strings attached at all. But you go through this process of answering a variety of questions and creating a portfolio, matching your current risk tolerance and time horizon to a portfolio that we've modeled already and that we continue to remodel and continue to change. But the latest ones will be up there. And you check those out. And then if you desire to, $10,000 minimum investment, we'll continue to monitor, invest, reinvest, rebalance, do all sorts of work in the back end, and then you get to work with us. And it's really easy. And you have all the tools at hand to understand your performance, about your investments. Everything is right there. So make sure to check that out. On that, I wish you a wonderful week. We'll see you again next week when Bruce McCullough from HedgeEye is on the show. Thanks for joining me again. I'll see you soon.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.